Hail, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But I'm going to ask that you hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Dr. Igor Shafid, who worked with the biological warfare unit there in Moscow. He was trained at the military academy in Leningrad, and certainly he is well aware of the very real threat of biological, chemical, and the nuclear warfare, and of course what America needs to be doing to prepare for it, which we're not doing. And we're going to actually sort of divide tonight's program into two parts. And the first hour, we're going to talk about Dr. Shafid's experience living in Russia, what it's like to live in Russia, and, of course, what happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and then, of course, his personal conversion to Christianity and coming to America, and the difference between life in Russia, life here. And then the second hour, we're going to talk really about the message of his book, which is called The Red Zone, and that is how to prepare for what he feels and what I feel, the assuredness of one day America is going to see terrible times. And I believe America is going to see terrible times because we've turned our back on God. And there's no incidents in all history where a nation has turned its back on God, where God has not brought punishment on that nation. And I believe that America is a perfect example to those who much is given, much is expected, and America has been tried and found wanting. And I love this country. This is my home. I'm staying here, trying to sound the warning, and I feel that in many respects Dr. Shafid is as well. Thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Yes, Dr. Stan, it's a pleasure talking with you this evening.
Well, this is the third time we've been on together this week, but of course with the other programs, the other networks that we do. And so I'm going to let Dr. Shafid tell you just a little bit about his background in Russia, being raised in a family where the mother and father, they were both members of the Communist Party, weren't they?
Yes, I was born in 1965 in Leningrad, and my both parents was members of a Communist Party, and my mother, she was a professor of history of communism in one of universities in Leningrad. And of course, when I was raised, atheist, and I didn't know God. I didn't have any connections with the Lord and any information about His existence. And in 1982, I was accepted in Soviet Military Medical Academy in Leningrad, and in 1988, I became a military physician, first general practitioner, and specialist on the troops protection against weapons of mass destruction, and after I specializing on internal medicine. And in 1993, I left Leningrad, I'm in St. Petersburg at that time, and I moved in the United States.
All right, well, we're going to be back here in just a moment, but the story really is a fascinating story. And I think what is really I've learned from reading the book is called Inside the Red Zone. I've read it from beginning to end. It's a book you'll want to get and you'll want to read as well, because it's, well, it combines, of course, the history, the story of what it is to live under communism, what it is to live in post-communist Russia, and then, of course, Igor's personal transformation as he came to know the Lord Jesus Christ, and, of course, his concern over the very real danger of the things that are happening in America today. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Dr. Igor Shafid. All right, fine. Well, we're going to just sort of go ahead. Now, of course, you start out, your mother and father were members of the Communist Party. Wasn't it sort of an advantage to be a member of the Communist Party? You could at least get an apartment that way. It sounds like living in Russia, you know, if you were not a member of the Communist Party, was pretty miserable.
Yes, that's why many true believers, Christians, had a real difficult time in Soviet Russia. And of course, I did not know that people was imprisoned not only for political views but for beliefs in God in Soviet time. And again, my both parents was part of Communist Party. Just probably, I don't believe they believed in communism itself, but because of comfortable life and some perspectives in life. Even for me, because if they could not be a communist, for example, I had no chance to get into military academy I did. So, and of course, life in Russia was surrounding people who were members of this, well, most part, only one single powerful party in Soviet Union, and everybody tried to build their careers up to the chain through that party as much as they could. So, well, my parents was no different than other people, definitely.
Well, one of the things that really impressed me so was that so many people never had an apartment. They would have to wait for literally years to get an apartment where they could live by themselves, and even then it wasn't very luxurious.
Yes, it is correct. After Second World War, many people, many buildings was destroyed, and when Soviets rebuilt new cities and new buildings, there was a very large shortage of apartments for people. So many people lived together in one large apartment. And in Leningrad, for example, old buildings, they had like 15, 20 families lived in one apartment with one kitchen and one bathroom.
15 to 20 families living in one apartment. I mean, people here in America find that difficult to believe. But what a different world it was there where you were raised than where we have been raised.
Yes, and you know, when you need to stay in a line to brush your teeth, it's kind of a difficult, especially it's not even your members of your family staying in a line. And of course, a shortage of food was experienced for a long time after Second World War, and also much food was going towards different directions. For example, eggs in Russia, many times I remember shortage of eggs. And honestly, the reason why was no eggs...
Hold that thought for just a moment here. We'll bring other stations back on board here.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Igor Shafid. He's, of course, lives in America now. He's lived here for almost a decade, a little over a decade. He was saying that in Russia, why after the Second World War, 15 or 20 families would live in an apartment. And, of course, there would be one kitchen, there would be one bathroom, you have to stand in line to brush your teeth. You might have to wait 10 or 20 years to be able to get a very small apartment just for your own family. And lots of times, of course, when couples got married, I understand that, you know, they would have to move in with the family until they could wait 10 or 15 years or whatever it would be to get their own apartment. And he was saying there was a shortage many times of eggs. After the Second World War, there was a terrible shortage of food. And even when he was coming along, there would be shortage of various things like eggs, which we take so much for granted. But what were you going to say about the shortage of eggs?
Yeah, so actually eggs was going towards biological programs because there was growing smallpox, variola major, inside the egg's embryo, and that's why most eggs was going towards that biological research, and that's why sometimes people didn't have eggs simply because they all was in research institutions, and that's one of the reasons. But of course, shortage of food was not only because biological programs was very large in Russia to develop weapons of mass destruction, but also because Soviet government did not take care much about people. All what they was taking care as a military defense or offense, and that pretty much was the biggest goal of Soviet Union, to build the most gigantic and most powerful military system in the world, which they did, actually, and they accomplished that mission. But during that process, people was become more and more poor. And finally, Soviet Union simply collapsed because could not go any further.
And, of course, you pointed out that they worked on a biological warfare program. And to your knowledge, they're still working on biological warfare, aren't they, even though they're supposed to have stopped?
Yes, they have some research, I believe, going on in institutions like Novosibirsk City. It's called Skoltsevo Biopreparation Institute of viruses, and they're doing cloning of different types of viruses there, including variola major and different hemorrhagic fevers. But institute in St. Petersburg, it's called Institute of Ultra Pure Biopreparation, or well known in Leningrad, Institute of Plague, because that's what they actually developed there as a plague, or super plague, so called, as a biological weapon, pulmonary plague. In other words, some research is still going on in Russia. Of course, it's a very super secret type of research, and they're very small because no finances right now. Russia quite poor right now, but I don't believe they ever stopped.
Well, I think what was so interesting, you were talking about how, of course, they would create not only a smallpox, but they could take the smallpox, the infectious part of the smallpox, and put it in into plague or into other things, and they could create these horrible diseases, part bacterial, part viral, would be devastating to a population, and that the Soviet Union has never really repudiated the idea of using these things any more than they've repudiated the idea of using nuclear weapons on their enemy, which is the United States. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, it is. And unfortunately, they start research on a genetically modified microorganisms or recombinant DNA technology, so-called. Practically in the late 70s, 80s, very intensively, they was doing a lot of research to develop different type of genetically modified pathogens. Like you mentioned, smallpox, for example, or so-called blackpox, for example, variola major with some genetic properties of hemorrhagic fevers, or different type of bacterial with genes or codes, codons of viruses inside implemented. So this type of different type of weapons of mass destruction, practically. And in some cases, they were so powerful that they're simply uncontrollable. In other words, sometimes they can start mutated uncontrollably themselves. And in that case, it's practically 100% mortality rate if anybody releases that type of agents, because no vaccination and no type of any immunoprophylactics and no type of treatment exists today against that agent.
And of course, when you speak of hemorrhagic fever, you're speaking of Marburg's disease and Ebola. They're really kissing cousins. What's so interesting about Marburg is that it first appeared in labs in Marburg and elsewhere in Germany, but they came from laboratory monkeys, and I've always been very, very concerned that so many of these diseases were first identified in laboratory monkeys, as if maybe they came out of the laboratory rather than appearing spontaneously out of the jungles. Did you ever have that thought as you evaluated these things?
Yeah, I always have a hard time to believe in spontaneous mutations somewhere in the jungles, because I always can sense that in many cases it's a man-made pathogens. And even today, like a SARS, so famous SARS virus, and different new strains of different type of viruses. Of course, they can mutate it, but sometimes when they become very aggressive, unusually aggressive, and hold some very specific properties, sometimes you can say, this looks very strange. In fact, when it's coming from Asia, I always questioning, is this is just a natural a strain, some kind of a mutated, or it may be coming from Chinese biological programs which exist, and they, I believe, very powerful, but very, very secret and unknown for anyone in the world today.
And I was very interested reading your book. You just mentioned, sort of an aside, that, you know, when you were there in Russia, of course, working within the medical system, and you, of course, AIDS came along, and it was the belief in Russia that AIDS had come from the biological laboratories here in the United States. Was that a fair statement?
Yes, I remember our colonels and professors of medicine military there was teaching us that actually United States developed AIDS, HIV, and it was tested in Africa for the first time. I don't remember, probably something in the 70s, maybe early 70s, and somehow lost control, and that's why actually all that practically spread all over the world. But I cannot prove that statement, of course, because Russians were suspicious to anything or anybody, and of course anything unusual development was immediately caught attention of, you know, KGB or military medicine in Soviet time, and only one explanation they always was looking for, to blame United States.
Of course, over in the United States, why, we always wanted to blame it on the Russians. And of course, this is the tragedy. We're always sort of many times looking to the wrong source of where some of these things have come from. Well, let's get back into your personal experiences, because certainly you were a very young man. You were very, really, how old were you when you graduated from the military academy?
I was 23 years old, so I became a physician at 23 years old.
And you graduated then as a physician?
Yes, I was a physician, yes. I was a general practitioner at that time and a lieutenant, a military physician.
And, of course, you were fortunate in some respects you were fortunate, because you were sort of worked into a marriage with the daughter of a very, very powerful Russian general, and that's sort of how you get ahead. And this was really something your family had arranged for you, wasn't it?
Practically, it was arranged by my parents and her parents. I honestly didn't have much interest at that time and in married anybody, except I tried to find escape, and I know many of my cadets, military cadets, they actually married only for one reason, to get apartment outside the system so they could have a little free time from the military system. But in my case, I saw a different perspective, because it was a very powerful connections in academy. My ex-mother-in-law was holding, because she was a chief nurse in one of the military hospitals in academy, and they knew definitely a lot of very high-ranking people, including chief of academy and different high-ranking generals in Moscow. And in other words, my life, I was recognized that my life could change, and it did change, actually.
And but this was something your parents wanted, and I know pretty well what it's like. I can remember when I was very young, and my parents had such a tremendous impact on my life, and I'm sure they always wanted the best for me, as your parents wanted the best for you. And, of course, it did give you certain advantages, you know, because of the marriage, but unfortunately, it did not work out. But we can talk about that perhaps down the line. Anyway, of course, there was tremendous emphasis on chemical, biological, and nuclear warfare in your training, because the Soviets had always, apparently, reading your book, had believed that a war was going to come sooner or later with the United States, and that these terrible, terrible weapons of mass destruction would be part of that war. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. And in fact, Soviet time is past, and many people in the United States got kind of relaxed. But what I can see in Russian Federation today, including military, it's days coming back. And I can recognize that intensity of disbelief to the United States, again covering Russian citizen brains, and this is a dangerous condition. So we might go back to the same, not maybe Cold War, but the same condition when Russia start closing the doors and start building up again military offense systems.
And of course they're developing new intercontinental ballistic missiles, we're just destroying our theirs because ours, because our president has looked in Putin's eyes and he knows he's a good man. So we're destroying our weapons. They're in full military production for war. And, of course, their strategic forces are increasingly strong as we unilaterally disarm. Doesn't make much sense, but maybe behind all of this, God does certainly play a part. We'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Igor Shafid, and Dr. Igor Shafid, and of course is a Soviet military physician trained there. He understands the way that the Russians think, and of course they had always felt that there was going to be a confrontation with the United States. And of course, when you were in Russia, there were certain accidents that occurred. You described one that we never heard about here in the United States, and that was one involving an accident about a nuclear submarine. Would you like to talk a little bit about that, and then the devastating effect of that radiation on the victims of that accident?
Yes, it happened in 1985, so I was at that time as a military medical cadet in Leningrad Military Medical Academy, and it happened in Chasma Bay. It's an area probably about 50 miles away from the large city Vladivostok in the Far East. They had a very huge nuclear submarine fleet right there. And when they was changing nuclear reactor fuel rods, used one, old one, and practically a crane was, the whole nuclear reactor from the submarine was hanging on a crane. And unfortunately, in the same bay area, high-speed torpedo boats was testing by Soviet Navy SEALs. They create large waves, and a crane was stationed in the water. And reactor start kind of balancing left and right and hit the crane and actually exploded. So it was one of the kind of classified incidents, and it was a nuclear submarine nicknamed Shark in Russian, if I translate from Russian. Anyway, 10 sailors died immediately from a gamma neutron impulse, and about 37 sailors developed very, very serious acute radiation illness. They got very high doses of radiation, and about almost 200, over 200 people, probably about 300 people total, was hospitalized with acute radiation illnesses, and they received different doses of radiation plus local radiation injuries because they was cleaning all this mess sometimes by hands. And it was a very quick operation, and KGB put a lot of pressure on people. So at that time, they removed highly overdosed responders, sailors, towards hospital, Navy hospital, military hospital in Leningrad, in the same academy where I was stationed. And I had opportunity to see these people and seeing how actually radiation seriously affect their health. And all those people died in about 3-4 weeks with intense medical treatment and intense research, of course, was done on that people. But it was very horrible, very difficult to see because many of those people was young, unfortunately 18, 19 years old men, and acute radiation syndrome was very intense, and practically complete depletion of the bone marrow cells completely with complete depletion, and very intense hemorrhagic syndrome. Many died from internal hemorrhage. Some of them lived through, and they died after that from secondary infection. And that was a very sad time, but even their relatives never met them, and they had no access to any people, in fact. And even some medical personnel could not go inside that isolation or wards because...
Hold that thought here for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and Dr. Speed is telling us about what happened. It was in the mid-1980s when he was a cadet there at the Leningrad Institute, and there was an accident involving a Soviet nuclear submarine where they were pulling the core out. It got loose, and there was a tremendous amount of radiation. And how many young people died there as a result of the accident or the result of cleaning up after the accident from acute radiation illness?
Yes, well, the given number, about 37, died in about 3-4 weeks. But I believe number was much higher because not only our facility was taking care of these victims, but different other regional facilities, military as well.
And, of course, everything was top secret. Even the families weren't allowed to actually visit and find out what had happened. Is that right?
Yes, it is right. And, in fact, when they died, I don't think they even know where they graves today because usually it's... they're usually saying that some casual mistakes occurred during the service in the military. Sorry, but we cannot give you back their bodies and we cannot locate their graves as well. So it, sometimes it was a typical message for the families of servicemen who was in the Soviet Army, unfortunately.
And, of course, everything is cover-up concealment. And, of course, the same thing happened when they had that release of anthrax. When was that? That was sometime in the late 1980s, wasn't it, when they inadvertently released some anthrax in one of the towns there where they were experimenting it?
Yes, it was a Sverdlovsk. It happened in 1979. And supposedly it was a mistake. Somebody forgot to change the filters in the system, and anthrax was released. Surprisingly, it was a multiple strains of anthrax, and it's actually, with the wind, across about 50 kilometers long, and it's contaminated very large areas in two military bases, base number 19 and 32. And unfortunately, many people died, but again, known numbers, it's about 66 people died from that very unusual, powerful anthrax with a very strong hemorrhagic properties. But honestly, prisoners and soldiers was cleaning a decontaminating soil and everything else and buildings by hands, sometimes without any protection at all, and they also died. So actually, numbers, I believe, much higher than 66.
Now, of course, this was a pulmonary anthrax. Was this this was militarized? This in the spores that go into a dust form, and of course, they'd be inhaled, and then of course, you get this terrible pulmonary anthrax, for which you know, unless you can get massive antibiotics into them, a significant number do die.
Yes, it was a pulmonary anthrax, and one of the weaponized anthraxes. Yes, very powerful.
Now I understand, though, that most of the Soviet military was actually immunized against the anthrax.
Yes, I actually was receiving immunizations quite almost every year, and was a different type of immunizations called STI vaccine. It's a live anthrax vaccine, and it's powerful, but it only works for about 11, 12 months, and after you need to revaccinate again.
Well, now, of course, aren't there various strains of anthrax, and can you immunize against all strains of anthrax, or just certain strains that you're working with?
Practically only certain strains, and it's a high spectrum of different strains, of course, but mostly in Soviet Army, they start revaccination about 1987 again, because they stopped for some time, and I do believe because anthrax was one of the main strategic operational weapons, and they was protecting soldiers and officers with a specific against specific strains, and that's why vaccinations was very specific.
But
I was involved in vaccinations myself. I did mass vaccinations in Poland when I was in the service as a chief military battalions against anthrax as well.
Now, did they immunize the civilians or just the or just the people who worked in the factories and in the military?
Well, in Poland, at least I know, was immunization not only military personnel, but I did Ministry of Internal Affairs, civilian employees, some KGB. In other words, everybody who had any possibility get in contact in any way with anthrax.
All right. Well, what about excessive immunization? I've talked to Ken Alibak, and I'm sure you know who he is.
Yes.
He had worked the number two man there in the Soviet system. He said that, you know, you can't take too many immunizations because, of course, you'll get allergic to everything. He told me that he couldn't touch anything. He had difficulty eating anything. He was allergic to everything. Is this a problem with everybody or with many people who take multiple vaccinations?
Yes, well, we have, yes, it is a problem because practically body gets, simply develop allergic reactions and immune system start getting more and more weak. But we was our academy was involved in research on super immune modulators.
Hold that thought, we'll have to get to that in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Igor Shafid, and of course he was in the military academy there in Leningrad, and of course worked with this. We were talking about the problems with multiple vaccinations. Now, I know that Ken Alibak, who was the number two man in the Soviet biological warfare system, had told me that he'd taken over vaccinations for over 50 different diseases, because these were all diseases that the Russians were working at, the communists were working at the time. So he had to be immunized against all of them, which he'd come in contact with. And he said he'd gotten to the point where he was just allergic to everything. So you were beginning to tell us a little about your concern about over-vaccination. Would you like to pick up that thought?
Yes. And again, my first vaccination I received when I was 5 years old, and it was against bubonic plague, very powerful vaccination. I almost lost my left arm, but I didn't. So I developed very strong reaction, powerful. I was sick for months. I almost developed bubonic plague, actually. But I didn't, you know, die, and I developed very powerful immune resistance against plagues, Yersinia pestis. But the point is, yes, Soviet Union vaccinated us quite often, and specifically when I at 17 years old age, I get in military academy, we had a special schedule of vaccination. But this is a whole complete training process. In other words, we was trained not only our bodies to receive vaccinations, but we also was trained physically. And when person in combinationally train, actually this is when person can stand against real serious releases and strains and not to get, you know, inoculated. Or even if it's inoculated, practically pathogen can die inside the organism. And my example, we was working with adult chickenpox and adult measles in the facilities with almost level 4, level 3 protection, isolation protections, and I sometimes never even use a mask and gloves on me, and I never got sick because I was constantly vaccinated against that type of a diseases. And that's a reality when you can actually stimulate your body to the point when you need to go, you need to do the job, and honestly, even if it's a highly contagious patient, you do a medical exam, you touch in person, you're taking samples and everything else, and you still be healthy without even any level of protection on myself.
Well, of course, when I dealt with infectious disease, we always wore caps and gowns, and, you know, I was always very, very concerned, especially dealing with tuberculosis. And I was very young, a young physician working in the infectious disease ward. But we'll be back here in just a moment with Dr. Igor Shafid. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking about Dr. Shafid's life in the Soviet military, and then of course, he eventually decided he wanted to get out of the military. He just wasn't happy doing what he was doing. And of course, one of the things you talked about certainly was the corruption that was part of the very existence there in the Soviet Union. How everybody was involved in the black market. Even many of the people from the KGB were siphoning gasoline out of government vehicles and selling it on the black market. Is that what was the background of the black market there in comparison with the open market?
Well, most people who had any type of connections and little or big powers, they always tried to sell something on the side for only one reason. We all was on a very dry salaries, and it was never enough. people had dreams, even KGB agents. They want to buy a nice car. They want to, you know, have a maybe expensive furniture. They want to buy, you know, their wife's expensive jewelry. So they couldn't afford all those things and their salaries, and that's why they did all this type of a black market. Like, actually, in Poland, for example, they were selling mass numbers, just a simple gasoline. When gasoline, when they finished with gasoline, there was a very big black market on diamonds from Siberia. And many Polish secret service was involved in that black market. They was rebuying the diamonds and reselling them further, like in Germany and other places. So that was a kind of a business place.
Well, my understanding is that, you know, one of the only thing that kept the Soviet economy going was the black market. I mean, everybody was in the black market. I mean, there was the open market, the black market, but people, you almost had to be in the black market to survive.
That's true. And, for example, for officers like me, we all knew if I'm in Poland in a service and I need to make some money, what I do, I just buy in Russian TVs, color TV, probably 2-3 sets. I need to bring in Poland. I can resell that TV sets for Polish, and after that I can buy a very nice furniture, just simple as it is, or refrigerators or something like any type of equipment.
Now, you were a physician. What was your salary as a physician there, as a lieutenant?
Well, in comparison, actually, I probably make 4 or 5 times more than any surgeon in civilian departments in Soviet Union, because I was outside the country, and plus because I was a military physician. So actually, I was making, well, not bad money at that time. If I translate in United States dollars, it still be look small, maybe $200 a month.
You were making $200 a month, but what was the surgeon, working a trained surgeon in Russia, making?
Well, today they probably make, if they're lucky, $150, but in the Soviet time, it was about $50.
About $50 a month.
Yes. 50,
now, there's no way you can live on $50 a month, so you must have to be bribed, you know, or accept bribes just to survive.
That's right, and many, unfortunately, that's what they did. They couldn't live just on a normal salary, no way.
I remember talking to an obstetrician. I think he was from Romania or Lithuania or someplace like that. And he was making $50 a month. And I said, how do you survive? And he says, everybody accepts bribes. The nurse accepts bribes. Mm-hmm. That's the only way you get in to see the doctor. You have to bribe the doctor to get treatment.
Yes,
is that really the way it works?
Unfortunately, yes. And I know many friends today, to make extra money, they actually driving taxi cabs at night as a part of a job, another job. So they're doing medicine in the daytime. At night, they're using their own vehicles to drive passengers to make extra money.
And, of course, this is the end of a socialist system where the government is can provide everything for everybody. But, of course, there isn't enough money to do it. It doesn't work. And so the people have to learn how to work around the system. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, absolutely. Even today, actually, it's become a gigantic problem for Russia, and the black market in Russia today becoming a very large problem, including weapons of mass destruction black market. And that's what the real scares, because Russia has so much stockpiles of anything. And in many cases, people have enough connections, and they can bribe customs, they can bribe the military, stockpile, people who work there, and that's all possible. It's all can be taken outside the Russia and go in any unknown direction.
And the thing is that the people desperate, of course some of them have a criminal mentality, but others are just trying to survive in a totally corrupt system, and so they can sell biological or nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction, and there's always a market for them, isn't there?
Yes, even I left Russia in 1993. Already in 1990, rumors was going on in Leningrad that some people could purchase some devices, even nuclear, for only $50,000 at that time. But of course, prices changed. Today, we're talking about millions, and especially radiological material or chemical weaponized material on the black market, quite expensive if it's a good one. And they even have underground laboratories in Germany and Austria today They're taking samples in that laboratories for analysis, spectra analysis, to understand how pure and how good quality material before they purchase it. So it's like a, it's practically a professionally built, professionally organized business right now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Russian civilian defense system, because if this is what the American people don't understand. In Russia, the, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but the leaders there have always felt that there would be an exchange between Russia and the United States, and they were intent upon saving the lives of as many of the Russian civilians as they could, so they built massive underground shelters, and whereas here in the United States, our leaders didn't care whether the American people died or not. They actively discouraged any sort of civilian defense. But let's talk about what happened in Russia, what they'd done to protect the lives of the Russian people when you were living there. Could you sort of develop this idea of the underground facilities that they had to protect the Russian population?
Yes, well, we can talk about it. It usually was about like 3-4 sizes underground facilities. The smallest one was built not far from the schools. A little bit bigger facilities was built around factories. Practically every institution, including colleges and universities, had multiple underground facilities like a bunker systems built during Cold War in preparation to nuclear or biological war with the United States. And of course, larger facilities like, for example, subway system in Leningrad and Moscow have special entrances and exits to so-called underground cities. And that cities contain stockpiles of food, water, supplies, hotels even built right there. They had the roads, and in some special places it's still closed for a human eye. They even have they even had underground nice shops and stores, and people could live there for maybe 10, 15 years and never come out on the earth. And it was enough food and water for about 15 years stockpiled right there. And it's, of course, it's only for special events, like, as I said, nuclear exchange with the United States. And it's only for our government, their families, KGB, their families, for all special category of people. But that facilities underground could hold probably up to 50,000 people at once. So it's like a cities underground practically, still today controlled by FSB or Federal Security Bureau. In other words, exit is closed for anybody else.
Well, now, of course, but they did have facilities adjacent to the subways and adjacent to many of the factories where they did have underground facilities for the general population, didn't they?
Yes, of course, and survivability of Soviet Union was quite high. Just for example, after nuclear exchange with United States, I give you some numbers NATO was given. 60 million people in United States will die after exchange. 60 million, I said, after nuclear exchange, not including biological, just nuclear. And in Soviet Russia, only about 17 million people died, and everybody else be still alive. So just in comparison, you can see different numbers, just due to that civil defense program.
And, of course, the Russians have an active, at least they had an active program to protect the population. Now, I want you to know, it'll make you feel better, they built a special bunker under Dick Cheney's home there in Washington, D.C. It's people living adjacent were always concerned because of the explosions as they were blasting this out of the rock. So Dick Cheney will be protected. They have special places for members of Congress and for the bureaucrats, but absolutely nothing for the American people. And of course, there really aren't even adequate supplies in many respects for if something like this should happen. And in fact, I've been to civilian defense meetings with top FEMA officials, and they've said, we don't have a program to protect you. You better start thinking about protecting yourself. Now, this is within the last 4 months up here, right here, and actually, I think it was in Nevada that we went to this program. But anyway, the important thing is that our message and part of our message this evening is you're going to have to start thinking about yourself, because there is a process known as mutual assured destruction. In other words, the idea was, well, we can kill all the people in Russia and they can kill all the people here, so nobody would be crazy enough to actually start a war. But the Russians have never believed that. So what we really did was establish something called assured destruction, not mutually assured destruction, MAD, but simply assured destruction, AD. That was assured destruction of America. And there's been an organized effort not to have an anti-ballistic missile system, and the one that George Bush has created is really laughable. I mean, the Russians have, I don't know, probably 6,000 or 8,000 ballistic missiles, and we would have about 20 interceptors, but we're not even sure they're going to work. But it's great public relations because, well, the American people are going to feel safer knowing that we have some 20 anti-ballistic missiles, but we don't think that they're going to be able to hit anything because there's no explosive warheads on them. In other words, there's no nuclear warheads. The Russians have certainly an anti-ballistic missile system. They're preparing for war, and America is not. And it really doesn't make... And have you ever looked at what's going on and questioned what sort of madness is this?
Yes, it's a very complicated situation for United States. And I understand, of course, the amount of work need to be done on civil defense here in this nation is very large. And I also believe... we should start this long time ago, not today, not tomorrow. But it's still a great hope, because I believe the Lord is a great protector of this nation, a great defender of this nation, Lord Jesus Christ, and we need to put faith on Him. And we need to start actively involved high schools, colleges, and anybody who actually care about their own families and their own children, to start doing something actively, maybe even churches, because people still have money, organizations still have money, not the government, organizations, regional, local, cities, and it's all possible to find some resources to build some kind of a system, and maybe it's never be a perfect one, but it's at least if something happens, people will be educated enough to know what to do, and in some even cases, subway systems exist in the United States, and I always teach and responders that message. You should use subway systems in New York, in Chicago, in any places where they exist, and you can use them wonderfully to protect mass number of people, and need to be done, but for some reason, nobody researching that subject at all.
Well, let's Dr. Shafid's book, which is called Inside the Red Zone, which we will be carrying, that Inside the Red Zone has a whole section at the end of that book that tells you really the things that you need to do. And I was really rather fascinated as I read through this, a lot of things I hadn't thought about. For instance, you've all heard about the fact that if there is going to be a nuclear attack, what you're supposed to do is get plastic and duct tape. But nobody ever tells you what you're going to do with the duct tape. Well, Dr. Shafid does, and he actually he works. And who are you working with now, really, on this whole idea of civil defense and what people should do? Are you working with Bechtel, or what sort of a corporation is it?
Yes, I work for Bechtel Nevada, and it's called Counterterrorism Operations Support Department, and we train responders, all level of responders, on the issues with the weapons of mass destruction and actually how to manage hot zones, how to manage post-impact situations, and how protect responders, actually, not the civilian population, how protect responders when they'll be responding. That's our main mission.
Now, you have a website. Would you like to get that website out? Because we actually have two audiences. We have a number of stations up in the Great Northwest, and they'll be leaving us unless, of course, they're going to listen on shortwave or the Internet for the next hour, which they can. You're going to listen it for the next hour on the Internet. It's radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. If you're going to be listening on shortwave, I should let you know that our frequencies have changed. Of course, how would you know if you weren't already listening on shortwave? But for those who would like to know, you can always pick us up all day long for our afternoon and evening programs at 7.5. 7.535. That's 7.535. However, the evening program is also heard at the first hour, 5.835. That's this hour. The next hour is 5.970. But if you're not going to be with us the next hour, I want you to know how to get Dr. Shafid's website. Would you like to get that website out there, please?
Yes, please. It's www.globalstrategicresources.com, globalstrategicresources.com, and information on civil defense available. It's free at this website. And we also have a toll-free number. It's 1-866-240-5505, 1-866-240-5505. So if anybody want to purchase the book, they can call toll-free number. And it's available on Amazon.com, and they can also order at Barnes & Noble's this book, Inside the Red Zone.
And, of course, this is a fascinating book. It's, of course, it's the story of Dr. Shafid, and, of course, eventually, of course, it gets into his personal relationship with the Lord. So it's written from a Christian perspective, but, of course, it draws you into it because it has love stories and all sorts of interesting things. And then, of course, interspersed, but as you read the book, and, of course, you want to get to these parts of the book that you know are lying ahead, interspersed, of course, is a Christian message. And as he finds, eventually comes living in Russia, living in this state where, of course, everything is almost like hopelessness, why he comes to a personal relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, so the book is excellent. It's called Inside the Red Zone. And, I read a lot of books, but I think that this one has more great information in it, interesting reading, an interesting understanding of Russia, lots of great insights into the problems in Russia, but concerns about what's going on in America today. And we'll be talking, of course, about the model emergency health plan legislation that's in place. Maybe we'll even talk about that here before the end of this program. But, of course, we hope many of you will be listening for the next hour. If not, you can get the complete tape from Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and, of course, our guest this evening is Igor Shafid, and we're talking about his experiences in Russia. And, of course, would you like, of course, perhaps to talk a little bit about how it was that you left the Soviet military and what happened when you tried to get out and live within that really corrupt society that existed after the fall of the Iron Curtain?
Yes, well, when I left military, and it was between, it's 1992, I become active reserve officer. It took me about 1 year. It was a very long process and very painful in a way, because Soviet military don't like lose professionals and officers, especially medical physicians, because they put too much effort and too much was spent on me, I understand. And usually my service to the military should be about 30 years long, but I only did it about 10. So, and only because I had at that time my father-in-law, two-star general Kolesnikov, he helped me a lot with his connections to actually leave the army. But after that, I kind of had no longer good relation with him, because he looked at me like a kind of a betrayer in a way. Because he believed in the military, he believed in communism, and communism was God for him, unfortunately, and that's when our relations start changing dramatically. After that, I found myself in civilian clothes. I was kind of happy for some time, and I got a job at a civilian hospital, and there was a former KGB hospital, with the best equipment, best pharmaceutical drugs, very nice facilities. But unfortunately, instead doing medicine and train physicians and nurses, a lot of activities was going on inside that hospital. And sometimes people be surprised what that means, KGB hospitals, because it was built specifically for KGB actually spying not only on local civilian people, but actually they had a satellite dishes even could reach United States, and some rooms was very, very different, not like a hospital rooms, full of TV sets and very interesting stuff. But the point is, KGB was intensively involved in black market with a different Caucasian region, businessmen. They were selling a lot of weapons and different type of drugs on the black market, and it was a very difficult atmosphere to be in.
Hold that thought for just a moment here, and we'll be wrap up this program and get on to the next one here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to tell our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you believe that we give you a different approach to what's going on, if you believe that Radio Liberty is going to try to get people to understand that we are involved not in a political or psychological or cultural or ideological battle, we're involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, psychological, cultural, and ideological battlefield until people understand that this is a spiritual battle and that there really are truly demonic forces behind so much of what's going on in the world today. Not imaginary, they're real. There really are satanic organizations, Luciferian organizations out there. In fact, you can go up on your web, your internet, and type in Google and type in Luciferianism. Type in Satanism. Type in the Processed Church of the Final Judgment. Over 3 million entries there to the Processed Church, one of the most powerful organizations in America today, and the fact you have never heard of it is simply as a reflection of the degree of control that exists over what the American people think. You'll remember the names of a couple of their more prominent members, David Berkowitz, Charlie Manson. Oh, didn't you know they belong to the Processed Church? Maybe that's because they have tentacles into the media that controls what the American people think. But be that as it may, we're involved in a spiritual battle. And if you'd like a copy of my latest newsletter, which covers much of what we've just mentioned, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. You'll have to ask for the October newsletter. We'll send you one of them free of charge. That's the October newsletter. Just call us at 1-800-544-8927. And then, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to get Dr. Shafid's book, Inside the Red Zone, because the information here, you'll want to read the last section, the appendix, on what you want to do in case of a nuclear war or chemical or biological attack. And you'll want to have your suitcase ready. You have it sit there, and it's not going to cost you much to put together the things that he has. But the suggestions he has are so vitally important to the things that I, as a physician trained for many, many years, have never, some of these things you've never thought of, they're not things you would think of, and yet you should be thinking of them. And you're going to have to look after yourself and after your family. Now, I admit that certainly we're going to have to look to God ultimately for our protection, but we would be foolish not to make preparations for ourselves and for our families, because remember, as it says in the scriptures, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. Just last night I was watching television, and there on Taiwan, some fellow who was a Christian jumped into the cage with the lions and said, Lord will protect me, lion bite me. And you know what happened? The lion bit him. He was, of course, depending upon the Lord to protect him, and I think he was lucky to get out of there alive. You mean, don't do foolish things. I believe that the Lord can protect this country, but does America deserve to be protected? Is there an instance in all history where a nation has turned against God and God has not brought judgment on that nation? So if you understand that there really are spiritual forces behind everything that's gone on, and if you look at what's happening in America today, I would ask you honestly, if you were God, would you protect America? Or would you try to bring judgment to this country as the only way to get to the Christians of this country and the good people and bring them back into the fold? This is what happened to Israel time and time again, and this is one of the things that Dr. Shafid talks about in his book, how God intervened in Israel to bring judgment upon that population. Why? To save them. It was the only way that they could be brought back into a personal relationship with our Lord. So as you think about these things we're talking about, you want to get this book, you want to read it, because I believe that really terrible times lie ahead for this country. Unless there's a massive revival, my job and what we try to do, certainly 5 hours every day as we reach out across America, is the hope that people are going to hear this message and that they will turn back to the Lord. But if they don't, then of course we'll want to offer help to and advice to those who are going to have to go through some very, very, very difficult times. So please pray for America, pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And for those who are leaving us, why, we'll see you tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we will take calls this hour because I think we're going to be talking about, of course, how you protect yourself from the dangers of biological and chemical and nuclear warfare. And as I read Dr. Shafid's book, and the book, again, is Inside the Red Zone, he was talking about how, you know, back in the 4th century, why there were some, was it 100 million people that perished from plague, wiped out most of Europe? Was that figure correct?
Yes, it is correct. And this process was happened for not just a short time, that huge endemics of plagues or smallpox was existing in the old days for sometimes decades. It was just keep going and keep going nonstop through the different nations, and practically sometimes covering not only nations, but almost whole globe, but very slow at that time.
And, of course, there were other outbreaks of the plague. There was another one where 26 million people died, and this was, you know, at this, I don't know, 13th, 14th, 15th century. And there, this has been a recurrent problem down through the ages, plagues, smallpox, these other diseases, mass spread of the disease. And, of course, in those days, most people would not have any adequate immunization, and their immune systems weren't working. Many of them were, of course, did not have good nutrition, and they simply succumbed to the one or another of these terrible, terrible plagues that have swept the earth. And I thought you did such a good job in describing that and sort of laying the background for what you're talking about, the danger of biological warfare today.
Yes, and unfortunately, many people not realize in the United States that biological warfare, actually biological programs, it's a very old story too. And even there was developed first one laboratories in Soviet Union was opened in the late 20s, or middle 30s already. First laboratories for development of endemic typhus in a liquid form in the first time was opened in Leningrad Military Medical Academy in 1935, I believe, and they already had the weapons available to use in the late 1937. So it's a very long time ago, and it's a very old story, and many weapons of mass destruction, like biological pathogens, were stockpiled for decades and decades and decades, and in unknown locations in Soviet Union, and the whole world completely had no clue about that at all.
And, of course, the chemical weapons were stockpiled, the nuclear weapons, of course, they still have them, supposedly, why they're destroying them, but they will not let the Americans see that they're really destroyed or what happens to the nuclear material, and it's sort of suspected that it's being put on the new mobile interballistic missiles that the Russians have. We have no mobile intercontinental ballistic missiles. The Russians are building new generations every year or two. So why is it they're building and working in full production for war and America is not? Really doesn't make any sense, unless you understand that there really are powerful spiritual forces at work behind the scenes. Would you agree with that basic concept, Doctor?
Yes, absolutely. It's as simple as, you know, like you mentioned, it's a fight between darkness and light, between good and evil, between Lord Jesus Christ and Lucifer.
Amen
and
to that. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, it's as fascinating. I've never met Dr. Shavid, but reading his book, I could feel certainly a sense of camaraderie with him because he has come to some of these exact same conclusions that I have, or maybe I've come to the same conclusions that he has of the true spiritual nature of this battle. And America is being left wide open, literally for destruction, by leaders who seem to be blind to the very real dangers that exist there. And so we're going to talk this hour, in large part, about what people really need to do, thinking, because there's not really simply one method of mass destruction. There's biological, there's chemical, and of course there's nuclear weapons. And of course the idea is, oh, it's going to happen, we're all going to die, but what happens if you don't die? What about your family? And certainly, if people are prepared, a good part of our population could survive, couldn't they?
Yes, absolutely. And the some steps is so simple for every family. It's a part of civil defense, which not exists in the United States at all. And sometimes you need to leave the house, and you need to leave fast. And sometimes you need to stay inside the house and don't even leave and don't even open a door. And that little tips, little informational clues people need to understand, because biological release or chemical or nuclear detonation create completely different hot zones and completely different environmental hazards for population. In some cases, what I'm afraid, in the United States, most people will be simply running away, and that would be the biggest mistake. And that's when they can actually inhale biological material during that escape. That's the time when they can contaminate themselves and actually develop different types of problems in the future.
And, of course, your book is just full of ideas and the things that the average person would never think of, and you don't want to wait until something happens to make your preparations. That's why your idea of a packed suitcase for the family with the things in it that they would need. And it's not that they need a lot of things. They're not expensive things, but they're the logical things that you would need. But this is the time to start making preparation. That's why I thought your book was really so exciting, because you laid it out so simply, and sometimes we need to do things in a simple manner if we're going to motivate people to do them.
Yes, of course, and things like just a simple shampoo or, for example, plastic bags or non-alcohol baby wipes. I'm picking up one, non-alcohol baby wipes. In fact, just to have a roll non-alcohol baby wipes, and it can help to remove radioactive contamination from the face, for example, or other parts or open.
Hold that thought for just a moment here.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Dr. Igor Shavid, and we're going to be talking with him this next hour about what you really need to do to begin preparing for the unthinkable. Could the unthinkable happen? Yes. Could everybody escape to some distant area? Well, it would be nice if you could, but it'd be totally impractical. And you're a large city, and you know, if you're not in a terrible area, why, you may very well want to stay in your house, but you have to be prepared even to stay in your house and to know what to do. One of the things he talked about was having shampoos, but not a hair conditioner, because if you had a hair conditioner, what was the problem with the hair conditioner if you used that with a shampoo?
Yes, if it's a pure conditioner or it's a mixture, if person have radioactive material in the hair, what's happened, actually conditioner can bound proteins inside the hair follicles with radioactive material enough that it's practically glued together. And after remove that, radioactive material will be almost impossible. So this is why conditioner is no-no. Don't use conditioner in that case, only shampoo. And one of the best shampoos, in fact, be a Johnson & Johnson Control shampoo, baby shampoo, just because they have one of the chemicals is called tetrisodium EDTA inside, which actually very good can remove and granulated radioactive material and can remove nicely from the hair, from any surfaces, from any hair areas of the body.
Well, now, you mentioned, of course, the danger of nuclear attack. Where can people get, or can they get, without too much expense, some sort of a dose meter so that they would have an idea, you know, whether there really was radiation in their area?
Well, speaking of dose meters, they're very expensive. In fact, I can give you one site. It's called nukealert.com website. And they have a very inexpensive radiation meters or alarm system. And they also give you instructions. It's a key. It's a small keychain attachable personal radiation monitor. It's very small, and it's making a noise. And what's good about that, it can actually, it has no limits on exposure rates. But one thing for sure, it starts making a noise and more intense noise, the more dose person getting. That means person need escape. This is a very good tool, and it's very comfortable. Me and my wife already have in my keychain changed that, and it's only cost about $120. Well, it looks like a lot, but the point is all other radiation monitoring equipment, we're talking about at least $800,000, $1,500, or $3,000. So obviously, it's very expensive, and it's not easy to buy that kind of stuff.
Okay, and fine. So this is called the Nuke Alert. And,
it's called Nuke Alert, yes.
Right, and you can look at that on the Internet, or, of course, you can ready a research products that supports Radio Liberty, actually carries those, and I think the prices are... But anyway, you can look at Nuke Alert on the Internet, or you can contact us, and we can put you in touch with Bob Griswold, who does carry those. So... you know, there are things that you want to do, and you probably don't have to have one for everybody. It'd be nice if you did, but at least you want to have one for the family so you would know. And, of course, the more radiation is, why, of course, the more sound it makes on a regular basis. And they last about 10 years, the battery in there, so it'll last for a good long time. So at least you would know. And I would tell you that I don't think there's any time in the 42 years I've been involved in this battle that I've been more concerned about the possibility of a nuclear war, as we're increasingly, I believe, moving towards war with both the Iran and North Korea. And if you read the between the lines, why, there's no way that the United States is going to allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons. The trouble is she already has some, and if she is faced with the prospect of a nuclear war, what is Iran going to do to retaliate? So anyway, I think that people have to realize we live in a very, very uncertain world. Iran has close ties to communist China. Iran has very close ties to Russia. And if we got into a war, which side would they be on? And then what would God do? How would God intervene under those circumstances? And that's, of course, what nobody ever really likes to ask now. But I think that we really have to start thinking. Do you think that God will continue to bless America? As somebody once said, you know, America will be the land of the free only as long as America is the land of the brave. And what I hear so often, people come to me and say, well, gee, we're sorry behind what you're doing, Stan, but don't put our name in your computer. We wouldn't want it there. I realize that we've got an awful lot of people in America who really would never be classified as being brave. Well, let's get into what you can do, though, beginning to look in case the unthinkable should happen. And, of course, you have a list there of the things that people should have. Why should we have duct tape? I mean, people said, oh, well, you know, if there's a case of a nuclear attack, why make sure that you have duct tape and plastic on hand? And because everybody sort of laughed. But what would you do with that duct tape? Why is that important to have? And I had never even thought of what you had in your book.
Well, duct tape can be nicely used to tape all openings on our bodies. In other words, the biggest threat for us from the fallout, first of all, we need to have respiratory protection, we need to have eye protection, and we need to make sure we don't have any open skin areas. And we need it taped with a duct tape, put gloves on, and taped a long sleeve shirt, and if we have a long pants and a boots, I hope it's a boots, we need a taped boots to the pants, so we have no openings, so radioactive material cannot penetrate through and gets inside and get in contact with our open skin, and in that case we might get hurt and we might develop even some type of a so-called beta burns, possibly. So that's not be a very healthy idea. So that's why duct tape can be useful. And of course, another way, we can tape our open, actually windows if you want to stay in a house. And in fact, just one example, everybody who was at Chernobyl nuclear plant incident, some people, they wet large towels, just a shower towels, large one, and they stick the towels between the door and the floor, the entry door in a house, and they protect the furniture from contamination, from radioactive contamination. People who did not do that simple thing, they lost all their furniture and everything else in the house because radioactive dust simply penetrates through the holes in the house and contaminate everything inside.
And, of course, the people who did, it is a very, very simple thing to do. And the other thing is, of course, you tape your trousers to your boots or to certainly your stockings. You take your gloves to your long-sleeve shirts. And then, of course, when, of course, you get inside, you take off all of those things and you put them into plastic bags for later decontamination. But right now, you don't want to believe bring any of that radiation or biological contamination to the house. And then you talk about the importance of having shower caps and hats to protect you as well.
Yes, and shower caps is very good because if, first of all, it's good if hair is clean, for example, and I have only hot spots on my body. Hot spots is a contaminated areas on the skin. I probably like to cover my hair before I start taking a shower because it's very easy to contaminate other parts of the body like a hair. But also the hair caps can be very nicely used if I plan to evacuate. I like to cover my hair completely so I don't have any exit to any type of radiological material. In some cases, people even can buy a so-called Tyvek suits. They're very cheap, like $5 maybe, but they're not for sale in Home Depot or Walmart, of course. It's more professionally used Tyvek light suits, but they also have the hood, so they actually have only open face space area and nothing else. Everything else is actually covered.
Now, do you say they have those at Home Depot and at Walmart or not?
I never see the Tyvek suits right there, but I know they have available, of course they have available hair caps, you know, the plastic, and they have a HEPA filter masks available, and in Home Depot as well, and they also have gloves, of course, and boots, everything else that's available, so it's all available in any store.
And you talked about having special sort of like goggles. Would these be the goggles you would wear when you were, maybe grinding, sharpening things with a grinder?
Yeah, this can be used as well. That's right. And I think they're available also in stores.
Now, what about simply the surgical masks? Are they useful, or would the HEPA filter be the best one to have?
Yeah, I feel like probably HEPA filter masks would be more solid on the face, and in other words, they don't create any openings between the mask and the face, and then you'd be very tight to the face. Otherwise, it's no longer protecting respiratory tract. And surgical masks, they kind of, they have too much openings.
All right, fine. So there are just all sorts of things that you want to think about should the unthinkable come about. But you just said to get these things together, you've got a list of things. A pair of scissors is a good thing to have. And, of course, your duct tape. And of course, the wipes that you described, the various types of non-alcoholic wipes. Why non-alcoholic?
Well, actually, non-alcoholic wipes is the best to use for removal of radioactive material from the skin, because alcohol can, first of all, can dry the skin and remove the oil from the epidermis, and that might not be a healthy idea. And also, the biggest problem is it can dry the skin and actually sometimes open the pores, and that's not good.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment. And we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Dr. Shavid's done a lot of thought on this. He's actually works now training people all across the country. These would be the first responders because, of course, these are people who are going to have to try to escape from a contaminated area, but go into those contaminated areas. And they're not all going to have these fancy suits if they've got these fine military suits. Look, we can't even provide armor for our troops over in Iraq. Do you really think that they're going to have adequate protection for the people here in America? We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Igor Shavid, who is actually trained in chemical and biological warfare techniques when he was in Russia working with the Russian military. And, of course, they put great emphasis on protection of their troops and, of course, protection of the civilian population. For some strange, unimaginable reason, no emphasis being put on that here in the United States. And we're simply talking about the things that are covered in his excellent book, Inside the Red Zone, which you can get certainly either at Amazon, but we do carry the book. You can also get it from Dr. Shavid if you call his telephone number, and that's 866-240-5505. That's 1-866-240-25505. We think it's an excellent book. We think it's got excellent material in it. And it's something that, as we enter into a very, very difficult time, because I really think that the American people have voted for war. And, of course, Iran is sitting there. But Iran, of course, does already have nuclear weapons. Not a great number of them, but she does have some nuclear weapons. And what do you think she's going to attack if she is facing, or she is attacked, with a preemptive strike of sort? Is she going to do exactly what Saddam did and not resist at all? I think we're dealing with an entirely different mindset, an entirely different situation, and a very difficult, very dangerous situation for America. So let's get back, of course, to this whole threat, this very real threat, which I think is a threat, not only a nuclear attack, but biological attack. And one of the points you made in your treatise was that biological warfare in the battlefield is dangerous because it can come back and, of course, affect your own soldiers. But biological warfare on a country halfway around the world doesn't really endanger your own country, does it?
Well, that's why a strategy of Soviet Union strategic rocket force, as well as today Russian Federation, was to develop most contagious agents like a smallpox or Ebola, Marburg viruses, and fill them with in ICBMs and use them for on a far distances. So the distance, like an ocean between the United States and Russia, will be a protection, natural protection. They was hoping that no viruses can get back towards Soviet Union. And this is why in the European theater, they actually used more incapacitating type of agents like tularemia, for example, or maybe Q fever or brucellosis, something more slow going and not as contagious, or anthrax, for example.
Now, and of course, the other thing is that, of course, if you had a nuclear attack and then a biological attack, think of the chaos. That would be, I mean, first of all, your nuclear would knock out a certain number of our cities, but then a biological attack. The fear, this would be the big thing that you'd really have to worry about, wouldn't it be? Wouldn't you find just total panic within the cities?
Yes, the most possible. Of course, if it's a mass attack, we'd definitely be in a mass war, and most possible it'd be a left war, at least for, let's say, United States and Russia or China or whatever, who involved, I'm not sure, and that exchanged. But yes, it's called a sandwich program, in other words, a Napoleon cake. In other words, first goes nukes, second goes biological, sometimes chemical go first. It all depends. It's a different combinations exist in the strategy of Russian Federation, how to attack the enemy. But one thing for sure, whatever they was planning to do, it's always was close to 100% destruction.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were talking about the possibilities of an attack. Certainly a nuclear attack could be immediately followed by either a biological or chemical attack. Mass fear. You see, people think, oh, we're all going to die from a nuclear attack. No, not necessarily. It only hit the major cities. They would hit our nuclear deterrent. In other words, they would hit our nuclear sites, and you'll feel, I'm sure, very good to know that Bill Clinton, before he left office, gave orders that if there were to be a nuclear attack on America, we would not retaliate until after we had absorbed their attack. Now, they could completely knock out almost all of our fixed missiles because we're in the process of destroying the MX missiles. Right now, we're actually deactivating them. We're deactivating many of our nuclear submarines. We're pulling the missiles out and filling the silos with cement so it can act as ballast, but it can't be fired. Now, we're cutting back on the planes. We do no longer have planes in the air at all times, and we once did, so that they could wipe out our planes, they could wipe out most of our submarines, they could wipe out certainly all of our ability to reply, but then, of course, they could launch a biological attack immediately afterwards, and think of the chaos that would be in this country. Would anybody be that evil? Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about organized evil. So when you understand that, you may understand what this very real threat is. So anyway, as far as the biological things, there were a number of things that you suggested that people have in their kits. And we've already talked about the fact that you would have non-alcoholic wipes. You would have the baby shampoo. You would certainly have many types of gloves. You'd have cotton gloves. You'd have rubber gloves. You want to develop some of the ideas of the things that people really should have on hand in some sort of a suitcase in case the unthinkable should actually come to pass?
Yes, especially in biological attacks, recommendation pretty much the same. You need to cover the all openings in the body. And of course, inhalational hazard be most the highest one. And because only few biological weapons can actually penetrate the skin. But eyes and, of course, respiratory tract must be protected for sure and very well. Now, another thing people need to remember about biological attack, if they feel like they was out, I mean, if they was outside and something happened and they believe it's very suspicious, recommendation, first of all, before they go inside their house, they need to undress. They need to leave everything outside, not just laying on the floor, put in a double garbage bags and tight and just leave outside. And after go inside the house, and actually what they need is a hydrogen peroxide. They need to have a hydrogen peroxide. If the best actually works 3.6% hydrogen peroxide, if more high concentration even better. And they need to actually clean all the skin, open skin areas with a hydrogen peroxide, and after, probably twice. And after they need to take a hot shower, and it must be hot. I mean, as hot as possible. And after that, I say they can, all that manipulations need to be done in the mask. At least they need to have some kind of HEPA filter mask. After when it's done, mask need to be switched on a fresh one. And, of course, they need to clean the face if they feel like they have something in the face for the, in the first time. In other words, first attempt is the face because it's the most closest to the respiratory tract. And after that, they need to put fresh mask, and inside the house, they should have mask at all time. So So that's a kind of a little tools for people against biological pathogens.
All right, and of course, if you get the book, or you can go up to the website, and you just find the list of all the things that you would have on hand. You'd have a set of underwear in your little suitcase so that you could change all of your clothes, including your underwear, but you certainly don't want to wear the clothes that you had outside, inside, because you would not want to get the nuclear contamination. You certainly would not want to get the biological contamination into the house. And there really are so many different types of viral or bacteriological diseases that can be used that are lethal. And, of course, when you're involved in war, you do not worry about the civilian casualties. In fact, the more people that are ill, the sooner the country is going to be demoralized and will surrender. And as horrible as it can be, remember the purpose of an army. The purpose of an army is to kill and destroy. That's its purpose. And war is a terrible thing. And I think we have to remember what Plato had said. And that is that only the dead have seen the end of war. Ladies and gentlemen, you need to make your preparations. You need to understand the government has specifically and intentionally not protected our population, whereas the Russian government has gone to great lengths to protect their population. Why would that be? The Russians have a very effective anti-ballistic missile system. We have none, and the one that they put in with the 20 missiles in it that probably aren't going to work anyway is rather laughable when we're considering that tens of thousands of missiles would be released upon America in case of a nuclear exchange. So why are we doing what we're doing? Why, it's all perception, ladies and gentlemen. It's smoke and mirrors. It's rhetoric over reality. It's planned confusion. We'll be right back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Igor Shafid, and of course we're talking about what to do in case there were the unthinkable but happening. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And of course we think that you really should want to get the book. It's called Inside the Red Zone. One place you can get it would be 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or certainly you can call 866-240-25505. But the information, of course, is available up on the website at GlobalStrategicResources.com. Is that right?
Yes, it's correct.
GlobalStrategicResources.com, and that's Dr. Shafid's website, and of course he is actually taking trips around the country, actually training first responders. These are the people who would go into these areas that are contaminated with chemical or biological or radiological warfare instruments, and of course to help the people and to try to bring order there. How wide a training program do we have today? Is there are they really Office of Homeland Security is beginning to do beginning to prepare people for this sort of an attack?
Well, Office for Domestic Preparedness Programs, they're doing a lot of training right now for the last of 5 years, I say, or so, because I'm working on this project for almost 5 years already, and actually trained all thousands of responders in United States. The problem is United States is a not small country, and it's a lot of people live here, up to 300 million. So what that means, I don't want to use the word drop in the bucket, but it takes a lot longer to actually bring responders to the point of understanding and be comfortable inside the hot zone and be protected and not to make mistakes. It takes a lot longer than 5 years. And I like to see a lot more intense training and a lot more different facilities involved in the training. But so far we have a few main organizations who are actually responsible for this training for responders as a FEMA and the Office for Domestic Preparedness Programs, the Department of Justice. That's pretty much two organizations. And I know military doing also training, but it's mostly towards military personnel, not civilians.
And, of course, what we need is for people to understand that it may very well be that their bunker is going to have to be their own home. But if you're prepared, you may be able to survive. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Igor Shafid. And, of course, he had worked there in Russia. Of course, the Institute at Leningrad, where he had trained, dealt with some of the casualties that had come out of Chernobyl. In fact, it was very interesting. Igor talked about his uncle. His uncle had a pig farm. And his uncle was asked to go in to, of course, to help evacuate or clean up the area around Chernobyl. And even though he knew it was very dangerous, more than anything else, he wanted a car. And even though he was fairly prosperous in many respects, in fact, Igor talked about when he was very young, he used to go out to the farm and ride the pigs there. when he was a small boy. But his uncle, of course, wanted a car, how important that car was. And he was even willing to risk his life in Russia to get a car. And he did go to Chernobyl. And what was it, 4 or 5 years later, he died of leukemia?
Yes. He developed acute leukemia, yes. And he already had the so-called Chernobyl syndrome. It's not acute radiation illness, but it's kind of an intermediate syndrome. He lost his job. He lost 50% of his vision. He could not keep job because he had very short memory and problems with sleeping disorder, and he lost a lot of weight. His blood pressure was dancing in the morning and in the evening. Very complicated condition.
And, of course, this was, you feel, was related to the chronic radiation poisoning that he got. In other words, he did not have the acute illness, but he had the chronic radiation illness.
Yes. It's a kind of a unique, it's something between. So far, in medicine in the United States, they're not accepting that intermediate syndrome, or it's called neurocirculatory dystonia. That's a kind of a diagnosis for Chernobyl responders. We quite often was written there in Russia. But it's kind of an unknown condition when vessels unexpectedly go in spasm, and that's why blood pressure can go up very fast, and after they can relax and the blood pressure going down practically unexpectedly sometimes. Probably more research need to be done in this area, but I'm sure it's widely available, because I know we did research, not available, it's in archives of military, probably mostly medicine, but most archives in the military for some reason always closed for the public.
All right, well, we've got Bernice calling us from the great state of Michigan. Hi, Bernice, how are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I love the program. One thing he didn't mention that maybe you should is iodine tablets.
Iodine, yes, of course. Dr. Shafid, would you like to talk about the having iodine tablets? What sort of iodine and how much should be taken?
Yes, potassium iodine or KI can be used. Well, FDA approved 130 milligrams of iodine daily. 65 milligrams in the morning after a meal and 65 milligrams in the evening. And this is for adult dose.
And how long would you take that?
Well, that's a good question, because practically as long as the threat exists. You need to keep concentration of iodine inside your blood constant, because the problem is if you're not taking iodine daily till a threat of radioactive iodine no longer exists. Otherwise, the concentration can drop, and thyroid gland will not be blocked completely, and that's when radioactive iodine can actually get into the gland very fast.
And of course, it gets into the gland, why it tends to create a thyroid cancer down the line. Incidentally, Bernice, we do carry that through Radio Liberty. You can go to our website, and we do carry this potassium iodide specifically for this purpose.
Okay, thanks.
Anything else, Bernice?
He did mention the water filter thing that you have, too, didn't he?
No.
In case people aren't getting your materials, you know.
Okay, fine. Well, we do have a water filter. I don't know if it'll take out radiation. I'll have to check on that, but I'll have that down the line, okay?
Okay, thank you, Dr.
Thank you so very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Do you know if any of the filters out there will take out the radiation from the water? Because that would be one of the big things. You have to have water, and you worry about it being irradiated.
Yes. Actually, well, it's two conditions water happen, what can happen with water. Irradiation of water, when actually molecules start breaking down in pieces and develop that hydroxyl and oxime ions. So you cannot drink that water too. But it's due to just exposure to gamma radiation. And another, if it gets contaminated with radioactive material. But practically, filters, I don't believe I'll be trust filters which exist today, because mostly, you know, they're chlorinated, they're doing different changes and purifying water, but it's still probably some concentrations of radioisotopes can penetrate the water. And honestly, I will not drink water for the in the first days for sure, because the strontium-89 and strontium-90, it's a very powerful beta source, a beta emitter, can be present in all underground waters. After nuclear plant, for example, incident like Chernobyl, most underground waters become contaminated in days, and people could not drink any water from the ground, you know, underground water. So practically all what we need to have is a drinking water in the bottles, if we have.
Okay, fine. So you want to have some bottled water on hand anyway.
Yes, yes. That's right.
All right. So, again, our telephone number if you're out across America is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you have a question for Dr. Shafid, because he's done a tremendous amount of work thinking about this, and I'm very grateful to him for having this information for me so I don't have to do all the thinking. And, of course, the things that you need to do is, of course, make the preparation. Well, right now we have Barbara calling from Soquel. Hi, Barbara. Barbara, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. I have a question. We had a friend of ours who was a pastor who went to visit Minsk probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And at that time, the people who were living there did not trust the root vegetables, say such as potatoes, as far as, you know, eating them. I think some of them, they ate them themselves, but they would not serve them to visiting people. As like the pastor went there, they found out that they had spent a great deal of money to buy potatoes from a different area that would be safe to serve them, because they were still suspect of the vegetables that came out of the ground.
Is this fairly close to Chernobyl then?
Yes, it's not too far. Okay. I mean, it's not too close, but very large areas in Belarus still contaminated after Chernobyl, and it's the biggest threat today is a cesium-137 radionuclide, and it's staying in the soil, it's migrate very slow, and many vegetables and fruits actually contain radioisotope, this cesium-137, and it's a very hazardous radioisotopes, and that's why people cannot eat some vegetables and fruits from some contaminated territories.
So there is a danger for quite some period of time afterward then, if there is a nuclear attack.
Yes, it would be a very serious contaminated areas. And in fact, probably not after nuclear attack, but if a nuclear plant, something happened with nuclear plant, this is might be even a much worse disaster than a nuclear detonation of the nuclear bomb, because nuclear plant incident, Chernobyl-like nuclear plant incident, can actually create serious catastrophe for half of territory of United States. It just can contaminate so bad the territory and for so long that economically it'd be completely collapsed of the nation, practically.
Okay, anything else, Barbara?
No, thank you very much. Oh,
thank you.
Very interesting. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Well, let's go to Will, who's calling us from Missouri. Hi, Will. How are you doing?
Very good, Dr. Stan. I have a question for the other doctor in regards to water that's stored in barrels above the ground, like a food-grade water 55-gallon drum. Does the radiation penetrate through that drum, destroy the value of that water as well?
Well, it depends how deep they are underground.
They're on the surface in barrels.
Oh, so they're not very deep.
They're not at all deep. They're standing on the ground in barrels.
Oh, they're standing on the ground.
Yes.
Well, in this
case, barrels.
Yeah, and you need to know the thickness of the wall, and it's a stainless steel or what material, because sometimes depends how far, of course, detonation occur. I say from fallout probably be reasonably safe, but if it's not too far from the detonation site, it might be affected by ionization. But fallout, I don't think it'd be, as long as it's completely solidly closed, I don't think radioactive dust can actually, you know, create any ionization inside the water itself.
Very good.
It'd probably be safe.
Anything else, Will?
No, that's it. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome. And let's go to Ron, who's calling from Richland, Washington. Hi, Ron. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Dr. Shafir?
Shafiq,
how are you, sir?
Thank you. How are you?
Fine. I just listened to a talk from Major General Oleg Kalugin.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with the fellow.
Yes, I am.
Have you met him?
Well, I don't know him personally, but I know he was a former KGB, I understand.
Yes, sir. Major General. I was just wondering if you knew anything about him or...
Well, not personally. I know he, well, pretty much defected, and now he is working, helping United States government in different subjects related to KGB and spies and everything else like that.
Yes.
Okay, anything else, Ron?
Counterintelligence. I was just curious. I told him about Joel Skousen's website. I'm just wondering how legit the guy was.
Well, I don't know whether... I think that probably Igor doesn't want to comment on that one way or the other.
Yeah, he probably doesn't know. Anyway, that's the only question I had. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, I don't want to put you on the spot there. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And sometimes when I'm doing talk programs and people ask me questions, I just say I have no comment because sometimes I just don't know the answer and I don't want to say anything one way or the other, and sometimes that's the best way to be. And under any circumstances, our guest this evening, Dr. Igor Shafiq, and of course, really the book he has is a wonderful book. Now, because it talks really about his personal relationship to our Lord and tries to weave into the book the spiritual significance of so much of what's going on today. At one point, of course, he talks about something called the Model Emergency Health Plan Administration or laws that we have here that give, in case of a war, that the government would have almost dictatorial power over the lives of the people, and he's got an excellent summary of, we call it MEPA. What do you call it? Do you call it MEPA, Model Emergency Health Power Administration, or what?
Yeah, it's a Model State Emergency Health Power Act.
All right. Okay.
And it was, as far as I understand, was accepted in Florida. Well, we know why, probably in Florida. And I know some states rejected that plan, but the problem about the plan during biological event when FEMA call for crisis, and a lot of things might change overnight for this nation, surprisingly quick, people will be forced to vaccinate it without their will.
And I
want to be very clear on this. So even if they don't want, they will be vaccinated by force. And that's not a freedom act to me, and I can see a lot of danger involved in this type of documents or laws. And specifically, I recommend people watch and truly believe that biological attack happened, because sometimes message might come and it might not be a real message.
All right. I share your concern. Right now, we've got the lines already built up,
okay.
But I want our listeners to get the book and read that part, because I share Dr. Shafiq's concern there. And I'm going to go to our caller from Norway, and I hope I'm pushing the right button. Is this Leif from Norway?
Hello.
Hello?
Yes, I'm Leif.
Hi, how are you? Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
I have a comment. Thank you.
Now, is this the Leif who's called us before?
Yes.
Oh, okay, fine. It's good to hear from you again.
Thank you. Same to you. Now, I was at a church meeting. I am a Christian, too, and was at a church meeting some years ago, and a preacher from Sweden told a story about visiting Chernobyl. He was given by a pastor in Chernobyl honey, some honey. The pastor had some bees in his garden, and this preacher from Sweden was afraid to take that honey because he thought it was radioactive. And the pastor said, "Oh no, no, don't worry. The radiation leaves when the bees come into my property." And he took the jar to the Swedish laboratory and had it checked. And guess what? It was totally free from radiation.
Well, maybe the bees are smarter than people.
Well, I really would just like to comment on what this doctor said on the earlier hour, trust in the Lord Jesus.
Well, I think we have to trust in the Lord Jesus, but we have to make preparations too. It's like you don't jump into the into the cage with the lions and say the Lord's going to protect me. I think you have to be logical. And, you know, if the Lord takes us home, well, that's what we're supposed to be. But in the meantime, we're to do our best and to try to wake people up of what's going on.
Amen. Finally, two scriptures you can look up to just, it says, in Exodus 23, verse 25, "And you shall serve the Lord your God, and he shall bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of you." That's one scripture. And the second one was the whole Psalm number 91, which have been a protection for many, many people. I just want to comment on this.
Okay, what was that Psalm again?
91.
Oh, so yes, that's, of course, when they will fall to the right and they'll fall to the left and... right. God, that is a beautiful, and I agree with you totally. In fact, I conclude my letter this month with that quotation. God bless you, Lee. Thank you so much for calling.
Hallelujah. Thank
you.
Bye bye. Let's go to Bud, who's calling from New Jersey. Bud, go ahead.
Hi. I heard you mention this. Some of these listed items that you talked about were on the website, but I don't know if you meant that Dr. Igor Shafid has a website, or you have a website, and if it's his, how do you spell his name in the website?
Well, give your website again, please.
Yes, it's globalstrategicresources.com. It's one word, globalstrategicresources.com.
Globalstrategicresources.com.
It's one word.
And it's all, a bunch of this is listed there.
Yeah, excellent. I have available parts of appendix number 1 for you and your family, instructions for you and your family, with a list of necessary items also.
That,
all right there.
Is that okay, Bud?
Excellent. I'm sure a lot of people thank you for that just now. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And you get all those people back there in New Jersey listening to us. Good night. Okay, we'll go to Jack for calling from Michigan in just a moment here as soon as we get back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Igor Shafid, and we've got Jack calling from Michigan. Hi, Jack. How are you doing?
Oh, very fine, Dr. Stan. Thank you for bringing him out tonight.
Can you speak up just a little louder?
Sure. I wanted to ask what the doctor knows of the food irradiation occurring in this country, and secondly, what he thinks about all these highly credentialed, world-class microbiologists who have mysteriously died since around October of 2001.
All right, fine. What about the radiation of food? Is that something we should be concerned about or not?
You mean in the United States?
Yes, in other words, you know, they sometimes will irradiate food and to prolong its life.
Yes. You know, I don't think this would be a high concern because I think they're doing this for quite a while, and I don't, you know, as you know, reasons practically do make you sterilize on the food, and I don't believe it's any issue. Because it's not developing any secondary toxins. But speaking of, I believe 12 or 11 microbiologists, probably 11, I'm not sure, who mysteriously died because they knew too much or because they just pushed the wrong buttons on somebody's telephone. Well, let me put this way. It did happen in Britain and any other places. I do believe some things happen in Russia as well with some scientists. And, all that I can say, I'm glad I am not a microbiologist myself.
Okay, thanks very much, Jack. I think that there are a lot of strange things that are happening, but we've got to put our faith in the Lord. We do our best, and then we trust in Him.
Indeed, thank you. Psalm 91,
I think that Leif's suggestion is a great one. God bless, and thanks so much for calling. And right now, let's go to it. We're just about out of time. It's been a fascinating time. Would you like to sort of wrap up this evening's program for us?
Yes, please. My heart for American people, and I have a great hope. In my heart, I have a great hope that, yes, Lord Jesus Christ is the best defender for this nation for a long time. And I also want to tell people, American, actually, I want to use President John Adams' statement that our Constitution was made only for moral and religious people, and it's wholly inadequate for the government of any other. And I think Christian nation, America, need to realize that if we will lose Constitution Christian in this nation, we will go in the darkness of socialism and communism. And also people need to realize in this nation that freedom is not free. It's a gift from God, but it's not free. And it's very easy to lose freedom, but it's very hard to get it back.
God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Thank you.
All right, well, that was Dr. Igor Shafid, and this is the third time this week I've had a chance to talk to him, and I have enjoyed every minute of it. His book is wonderful. It's heartwarming, and, of course, I could see in him and his growing up and my own growing up and then maturing, and of course, he came to the Lord. I came back to the Lord. I suppose I was raised as a Christian, abandoned it, came back again. But it's a heartwarming story. It's a love story. It's a story of religious conversion. It's a story of the tyranny of communism. It's a story, certainly, of a situation of total corruption. And then, of course, coming to America, seeing the freedom that we have here, and realizing, as some of our listeners do, that that freedom is very, very tenuous. And the people of America, because they've never lived under tyranny, do not appreciate what we have here. And, of course, if they're not willing to stand up and fight for it, if they're not willing to take the time to get other people to understand that there are dark and sinister spiritual forces that control the leadership of both political parties, if they don't understand that there really are secret organizations working behind the scenes intent upon creating a new world order, a new world economic system, a new world currency, and a new world religion. If the people don't understand this, we will lose America. So our job is, of course, to try to get people to understand, to try to hope that there'll be revival, to pray for revival. Of course, we should pray and work. We have to do all of these things at one time, because I believe we're called to be witnesses. And, of course, that's one of the things that Dr. Shafid said. And this is, of course, what I have always said. We're to be the watchman on the wall. We're to be the people who are there shouting out, don't you know what's happening? Because if the watchman, of course, doesn't make the call, then the blood of the people is on his hands. But if the watchman, of course, does make the call and warns the people, and they don't listen, then the blood is on their hands. Could America be lost? America is rapidly being lost, and we're losing our vision of a free nation our people are voting for war, and this war is going to bring terrible things to America. And, of course, maybe we didn't have much of a choice. We had a choice of two members of a secret occult organization, both members of Skull and Bones. But, of course, the powers that be knew who was going to be elected, and they arranged it. They even had Osama bin Laden, or whoever wrote the script for Osama bin Laden, watch Michael Moore's film so we could comment on some of the things that Michael Moore had covered. And after all, who would want to vote for anybody that Michael Moore would opposed? Certainly, or you would want to, if somebody, Michael Moore opposed them and Osama bin Laden opposed him, you'd want to support him, wouldn't you? Well, anyway, I think that that was the October surprise. That was the funniest thing. If you've ever read what Osama bin Laden said in his remarks released to the American people just before the election, why would he do something like that? Or maybe Osama bin Laden doesn't even really exist. Maybe it was an actor. We don't know. What did he say in Arabic? What the government told us. How do we know it was Osama bin Laden? The government said it was. The message was directed to the American people to influence the election, and it served its purpose. Ladies and gentlemen, we're in real trouble as a nation. You need to understand what we're talking about, the secret societies. You need to read my October newsletter. If you don't subscribe, shame on you, but we'll send you a free copy if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Hope you'll subscribe. You can get it now. You can get it on the Internet. It'll be available in about 10 days. It hasn't gone out yet. But you'll have to specifically request the October newsletter, or you'll get one of the others, although they're all good. At least I like to think that they're good. I agonize over them every month. But we want to keep you informed. We want to let you know and understand the true nature of what we're engaged in today. So this is the time when we ask you to remember our telephone number. It's 1-800-544-8927. We do have a few openings. A couple of people have canceled out for the Saturday program. If you're still interested, you can call in. And then, of course, pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until tomorrow evening, when we'll be here with Pastor Joe Schimmel, who'll be our featured speaker, one of our featured speakers on Saturday. May the Lord be with you.